Michael is Michael McGee, poet of Tacoma, who will read from his Ireland's Eye chapbook journal. Certainly he's a wandering poet, a poet who has wandered over many, many landscapes. And of course you hear of Joyce, of Caravaggio. He loves painting, he loves dreaming. What poet doesn't dream? And he has written also many chapbooks of his wanderings. One is called The Ireland's Eye. And he would wish to read something from that. Michael, go ahead,
please. This is from my journal. A walk along the water, not snot green, but gold gray. Snot green is the color Joyce picturesquely called it. Paul from Chicago, who is staying at my bed and breakfast, has made a sort of pilgrimage to Dublin to rediscover Buck Mulligan's journey in Ulysses. He tells the story of standing here at Sandy Cove, looking at the water, when an older woman interrupts his reverie. "I suppose," she says, "you've come to see the snot green sea." Ah, so much for illusion.
When you traveled, did you go to travel for writing poetry journal such as this, or was this something that just came to you through your normal note-taking and journal-taking?
This was my first trip overseas, my first adventure. I didn't make it until I was way into my 30s. I had to overcome my mother, who didn't want me to go even at the age of mid-30s, much like, I guess, an Irish bachelor would. So I had a journal with me, and it never even occurred to me that this would come to anything. But because of that, I ended up taking my journal and making a little chapbook. And actually, one of the soliloquies from the journal became the start of a play that I subsequently wrote and ended up being made into a movie called Shank's Mare. And I wanted to read a couple short little passages from Dublin.
Perfectly.
This one starts in London, actually. And this one, David pointed me on to and read it to me. And I said, "Hey, that sounds pretty good. Who wrote that?" And he said, "You wrote that." "Had my pack repaired for 30p. I bought a pair of high-heeled boots for £2. I sold my high-top shoes I bought in Seattle at $30 for £3 in a London hostel, all for an extra night or two in London, and men have sold their souls for less."
And their souls are sold probably to anybody for a penny so they can get another pint.
The soul does double duty.
Right.
"The wind is blowing around the house and I feel like I'm at sea," which is literally true. Everyone is at sea in Ireland. Also, everything comes in threes. A family of three girls where I stay, the Father, Son, and the Holy Ghost, and tomorrow I leave for the southeast coast. And on another subject, Irish women. They wear translucent raincoats, blue, green, and red, that are see-through. The light illuminates them, so they glow with an aura. So whenever you see them, the Irish women glow and move like sea anemone. Also, they carry umbrellas that balloon when they open with a kaleidoscope of different patterns. And in Dublin, where I stay, the world goes by, while I sit in the aquarium of the bus station. And below, I see the passengers in their twos and threes, on their P's and Q's, on their benches, waiting. While above, I wait in a self-service heaven, and I plot the courses of buses coming and going to Donegal, to Ennis, to Tipperary, to Waterford, while the departures are announced. Always there's a motion in a carousel dream that seems to me more under than over the sea. And in the middle of it all, I sit in a glass information booth, the hub of the universe, which we Denisons are the spokes of in an ever-revolving blue sea."
Very good. It shows very much your people watching, people observation, lovely personas that some are intimate, who you've met face to face, others who pass by moving like anemones. Very good. Read another one if you wish.
Okay, this is a poem from the West, Galway. And a cladda is a salmon weir, or a series of dams and ladders that allow the salmon to jump from one level to another. And often you see it. And in the part of Galway that I stayed, it was actually called the cladda. The Spanish arches are there because that's where the Spanish landed when they got washed ashore after the Spanish Armada in 1588. Mm-hmm. They landed on the west coast of Ireland. 13 swans. 13 swans on the tide in Galway Harbor float along the quay in single file. And the water runs against them. The swans drift. A salmon jumps ahead toward the Spanish arches. A flotilla near where Fitzstephen, mayor, in 1493, executed his son for killing a Spaniard, all for a maiden's handkerchief of tears. The swans mingle, fluffing their tails and bobbing for fish, dipping while the tide is out, taking communion in the shallow water where fishermen and poets drop their lines, beneath the salmon weir along the cladda. A swan arches itself half out of water in a mermaid's pose. On the canal beneath Salt Hill, I walk through the Spanish arches, home to the old site of Galway, where Irish-speaking seamen lived and breathed in their heady Gaelic. And I stay near Cladda Quay with Monaghan, his wife and son, a family known to all. And tonight he offers us a nightcap, poteen from potato skins that Piegan Mike served up for moonshines in the playboy of the Western world. And waterlogged with a heavy head, I float like a barrel into bed.
As you well might after poteen. All right, that is from the Irish journal Ireland's Eye, Walking Papers of Michael McGee. This is David Gilmore listening to Mike read. There are many books we have to look at here that you have published. Michael's well published. He has some chapbooks, but there is one of recent date called How We Move Towards the Light. In this one, he has collected many of the poems that are found in some of the chapbooks, such as Dementia, Love is a Blur. And one of Michael's favorite poems is to use famous artists' imagery, translate it into verse to give sound to the imagery. Would you like to read one of your ekphrastic poems from one of the pictures that you were?
Well, ekphrastic means poems about art, the right. Subject with the subject of art. So I'm going to read one called Chagall Dreams.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And then I'm going to read Love is a Blur. Mm-hmm. And David, just on cue, held up the cover. So now you can see Chagall right in front of you. You can see the rooster and the bride and everything tilting. But that's what this poem is about. And I'm going to follow that with a wedding poem called Love is a Blur, because David mentioned that. Chagall dreams. He is carrying his beloved Bella above the village green, tilting her sideways like the prow of a ship, while he paints with the hooves of a cow. And using the chimney steeple as his nib, he writes down the hour. A fish with wings flies by. Violinists play with their own bows. A pendulum clock is swinging above his head, the sun with the aura of a candle. Oh, if you could hold it, encircling it all, it's a world that you could put your arms around. A wash of never-ending sky, sea urchins in trills rising into the ether, where women grow like Russian nesting dolls, and roosters crow to their glowing wives, and everything sings in the windmill of nature in notes that only a poet or a lover could decipher.
Thank you. That's very, very...
And I want to follow that, even though it's not a strictly ekphrastic poem, because this poem is on the opposite page, and I don't have to go through a lot of page turning. Mm-hmm. This is the one I actually wrote for my wife for our wedding day. Her name is Jean. It's called Love's a Blur. Your hand spreads against my shoulder. Your eyes close, and you seem to see what's behind me while my back is turned. And we seem to be dancing in freeze frame, held there, yet we turn on our single pedestal. Your wedding ring with its triple garnets turns like Orion's belt, pointing toward my Taurus. We are fixed there, out of focus, certain we are not alone, because so much love surrounds us. Slightly naughty reference, which I don't think anybody ever picks up, mm-hmm. but the triple garnets were actually in her ring, mm-hmm. and the Orion's belt is the equivalent of my belt, and you're mm-hmm. going to have to guess from there what my Taurus is. I won't say any more.
All right. Poets know what you're talking about.
I'm going to read another one called As Though I Was Proust Taking My Evening Stroll. And this, again, is a very visual poem. I mean, David said ekphrastic, and they're strictly about works of art, and yet this one is about a work of literature. But alas, I was alone, and I felt as if I was setting out to pay a neighborhood visit like those that Swan used to pay us after dinner. And that comes from Swan's Way, the first book, in remembrance of things past. So this is my recreation of myself in the role of Proust, walking into my own neighborhood. I went outside, and there were crystals on the pavement, and the air was spun from lace, and the trees were candelabras, and on each limb, a lighted candle. There were many moons to watch, and a picture in each window, but no face. There was no Gilbert or Albertine to meet, no Duchess of Guermantes in sight in our neighborhood. Not where I lived, far from the Faubourg Saint-Germain, and the only party wasn't the salon of Madame Verdron or even Odette Swan, but a raucous leftover beer and garden party in a tent. I wandered over the lawn, floating across the streets of darkness, the corridors of apple trees parted before me. Jupiter was blazing, and Orion's belt had turned. Jean, I am here to remind you not to forget who you are, and to remember who I am, so we can still live on in our familiar names.
So is Proust a favorite that you read in your youth, or did you read it in your old age?
I read it recently. I read it like maybe 5 years ago. I decided to read all the volumes, the 7 or 8 volumes of The Remembrance of Things Past. I read it in English. I do read some French. Mm-hmm. I understand it's more difficult in French, but I read it in English. And it's one of my favorite works, along with Lawrence Durrell. I love Lawrence Durrell. Is another one I love. Dickens is another novelist. The Alexandria Quartets by Durrell is one of my favorite mm-hmm. works. Mm-hmm. And Charles Dickens and Thomas Hardy. And they're all great painters.
Yes, Thomas Hardy. You picked on Thomas Hardy as one of your poems for painting pictures.
I'm going to read you as soon as I can find it. Maybe David would help
132, me. 132, Thomas Hardy Listening to Jazz.
Thank you. I love it when you introduce the titles. It's more fun than when I do it. Okay, I try to imagine this guy, this Victorian with a walrus mustache. Baby, it's cold outside, and the leaves are leaving their fingerprints on my windowsill. O will-o'-the-wind, just take me back to those days of scant sunlight and children playing out back. What delight! I'd like to invite them in for tea. There was a time when the softest moon would appear, and now we drink our beers like cattle. We shake our shaggy heads. The death rattle is a wattle of what sticks in our throat. Oh, those long-lost chicken bones. Take a draught, holding these cold hands. Now, after the darkness yawns, I want to go to bed. I want to pull up the covers of the lawn. I want to sleep like a log in a potting shed. Yes, baby, only 6 more hours of light as I whistle through my missing teeth and twirl the long silver ends of my long mustache.
Just as the jazz of the title, Thomas Hardy, listening to jazz, has the antiquity combined with the more modern musical imagery and the contemporary baby it's called, that's quite a shock, the first phrase, the first clause there. And then you bring in again, yes, baby, only 6 more hours of light. That is a brilliant juxtaposition. Hello, poetry devotees. This is David Gilmour again. We're reading with Michael McGee, poems from his chapbooks and published works. And now I'd like to make a slight turn to a persona of some importance in Mike's life, Jean Musser. Tell us about Jean.
Jean is my wife. She died 2 years ago from dementia. I was with her for 20 years. She's a poet, a playwright, an art critic, former art critic for the Seattle Times, and went to the Jungian Institute in Switzerland. So Jean was brilliant and beautiful, and I got to be with her for 20 years. These are poems from a chapbook I wrote that she wrote that I put together. This is called Water Signs. On a day like today, it's particularly apropos. Water people listen with ears to the ground for what is hidden under. They leave faucets running and they splash through the center of puddles. They misplace their umbrellas and their glasses, and they prefer reflection to the true image. When in despair, they swim out of themselves, and they insinuate their presences like sly trickles into different niches. When you see a water person across the room, don't fancy all of him is there. Nothing seals him in. He is like a slow leak into a different space. Water people often have dew in their beards or their hair, and they haunt the reed-filled marshes with hooks unbaited. When the weather is warm, they slither into the water through tickling kelp and featherings of fish. At night, their sleep is purposeful to fin and swim. By dream, back to their amnion beginnings. Their lights stay on their windows longer than in most. When they grow old, they are like silver logs rolled to a softness in the water. May they be buried in their bathtubs like the Minoans. May their bathtubs be painted with lotus flowers and squid. And may they float into circles of bliss. May the water birds rush over them.
Beautiful. For the Northwesterners, the Puget Sound should imbrue you with the feeling of water signs.
This is called In Toledo, again by Jean. In Toledo, or Toledo, I hear the oranges fall softly to the ground. On stone benches in the courtyard, two old men play chess. A fountain splashes in sunlight, and from an open window a bird sings from its cage. I feel my spirits rise, newly born, like El Greco's vision of the Spanish count in the church nearby. My thoughts are among the overhanging branches. They play castanets.
Very good. Jean also was one who, as you can tell from that poem, delighted in paintings And she herself was quite the master at the poet describing classical painting imagery.
Quiet woman. I saw in the morning light, I think of Vermeer's quiet, solitary women. One sews as I do in that ink-dark doorway. Above her, the cinnamon bricks of Delft. The street is nearly empty. Another window, the same light, bathing her face as the strip of tapestry under the water jug. Willow leaves outside my window tremble in the wind, filter their sunlight in moving patterns over the palm tree beside me in a green gold flicker. Warm tea and honey curl down my throat like the little women from the little street in Delft.
Delft mentioned twice. What a beautiful poetic word, a name of a town, Delft.
And there's more, because I wrote a poem in answer to this, and I wrote it after Jean died. I wrote it the day or two after she died. And she left me a painting, the Vermeer print of that painting on the little street of Delft. So this is what I wrote 2 days after she died, using her painting. Outside my window, the little streets of Delft, in horizontal boxes, houses arranged as coffins, a passport of myself. Look out the window of the frame as though I'm a rabbit about to be shot. And waiting for the sky to turn the pale blue with clouds, like the view of Delft, into Vermeer, who never traveled farther than a few square miles, who lived within the confines of his easel and painted what was about to happen in his daily life. Happy to see the trees on his little street while I see shadows this morning, a somber sunrise without a wife. One I must learn to live within my brush strokes of sorrow, hoping to find a place to pigeonhole myself.
Michael McGee, reading from the poem that he wrote soon after Jean Musse's passing.
I have one more to add. Jean loved Russia, and I have a wonderful book called Natasha's Dance, which is about the cultural history of Russia. And again, after she died, I wrote a poem called Russian Dreams, and this is in tribute to Jean. Last night, you slept in your cocoon, the covers pulled around you, three pillows for your head. In your confetti nightgown, red stars in celebration, as though you were in St. Petersburg, visiting the Winter Palace or the Hermitage, the Neve was frozen solid. While you were traveling through Finland, looking at the faces of the dead, your eyes closed. Though you were only passing through, you cozied up to me, your head against my shoulder, reading my mind the way you do. I let you go on dreaming on that train where nothing had changed, hoping that when you awoke, you would still remember me by name. There was so much light reflected in your face from the snow, the soft enough to be an alabaster white. I thought it would bring you back to me, my nesting doll.
Again, the much traveling in the poem, over landscapes, in vehicles, in trains. You also were partly Odyssean in part of your life when you went to Greece, and you did write a miscellany of Odyssean poems from How We Move Towards the Light. They're in the first section of the new Odysseus. I wonder if you would like to try a few of those to get the image of modernity from antiquity.
Okay, this is called Odysseus in the Land of Letter Eaters. That's a Freudian slip, but keep it in. Odysseus in the Land of Lettuce Eaters, but it could be Letter Eaters as well. And this was actually read by Garrison Keillor on a Writer's Almanac about 5 months ago. And you know, he read it better than I did. But I'm going to try
You'll do it better than him this time.
I'm going to do the best I can. Odysseus in the land of lettuce eaters. I don't like being a vegetarian. Give me red meat to kill and a pair of drumsticks or some kippered barbarian, a French dip with au jus. When you're in a far-off place, you need lots of protein for hand-to-hand combat. There's nothing quite as tasty as a plate of fresh Mesopotamians. Or nothing like an Irish stew made with real Celts, or an Abyssinian beef jerky, or a nice Saracen stir fry. The rest is for your salad days. Odysseus has a sex change. Now that he has traded in his aegis, time for a second look, well-seasoned and commanding, his hair is like fishing nets. It's now spun into black stockings and big hoop earrings of the kind you could die for. His muscular upper body frame has now taken on a sports bra. He's all dolled up in boots and lace. It takes some getting used to, but sure, women can look strong as Maud Gonne with a nose ring, a force of nature forged into song, and a medallion on her war chest.
Well, Odysseus was a changeling, and Athena did a great job on him.
Odysseus was a woman.
His do was wonderful in
it
that.
It should be a new song, yeah. Odysseus was a woman.
Because you wrote as Odysseus, from Odyssean point of view, I imagine Jean would have been somewhat a Penelope in your thoughts. How about the one Odysseus among the ambrosia petals?
Give me the page.
I thought that here, perhaps, 21. Thanks. Page 21.
Thanks, David, for the scripture and verse. Odysseus among the ambrosia petals. I thought that here, perhaps, I could rest among the blossoms without sex rearing its ugly head until suddenly I could feel a sweetness taking hold. Maybe I could put down my aegis for once, relax, and not worry about being the faithful husband, and even wondering about Penelope and if there ever would be a homecoming. But in the meantime, she wasn't here, and the perfume was everywhere, while the nymphs were rearranging themselves among the spears of wild lavender. The ambrosia made me giddy, and I dropped all caution. I'd looked for a place to lie down. Maybe a roll in the clay wouldn't be so bad after all. So I gave myself poetic license. Oh, Circe, you turned my men into pigs. Could you care for an older man? I clasped her beautiful knees, and I prayed for a favorable wind.
Well done. I love these Odysseus poems, partly from my classical background, but when you were in Greece, what was the age that you experienced the Mediterranean?
I don't think I went there until I was in my 50s. So for me, Odysseus...
These are more recent poems.
Yeah, then. Yeah. Well, actually, it would have been like 85, around 84, 85. Mm-hmm. That's still, 20 years ago. But I was about the age of Odysseus. So it was a perfect age to be there. So I sort of channeled him on my flight as I went through the Peloponnese Peninsula and across the Mediterranean and Aegean Sea.
You read in Paris.
It was actually the Sylvia Beach Reading Room at Shakespeare and Company in Paris.
All right.
So I'm just going to read a couple more poems and we'll let those lie.
And these are still from How We Move Towards the Light.
Okay.
A recent publication.
This is sitting at the Sylvia Beach Memorial Reading Room at Shakespeare and Company in Paris. Very famous bookstore. Gertrude Stein, Alice Toklas, all of them. At first, the room is unnaturally quiet. And then a voice says, "You can take a book upstairs from the library, and you can read until midnight if you like." It might have been the woman with red hair. So you climb the stairs dutifully, just as others must have done. And the room is thick with dust. and the book jackets are all buttoned up, and so you pad in like an old retriever over the rug. Mrs. Dalloway, the title you settle on is nearest to your head, and then you sit down to read in the green easy chair, much like today, frayed at the arm as your sweater. Hours pass. Your eyes wander over the pages as you imagine the neon light, the houseplant, and the bookshelves leaning in to listen. Suddenly, a thought is born. If no one discovers me here, I could go blind as Milton. But no cause for alarm. There are only creaking floors and a few chairs with lumbago. As long as the siren you hear comes no closer. Meanwhile, Mrs. Dalloway lives her life in a respectable way across the channel. And Boulevard Saint-Michel grows to an uproar. The river rats of the Seine begin to move as footsteps on the stairs. Cracks in the ceiling widen to a face. The curtain is continually stirring, and the words beneath your fingertips rise from the page in a needle point as lace. Kind of wanted to end with that one because it goes back to books, it goes back to literature, and it goes back to travel, and those are sort of the themes. Mm-hmm. So anyway, that's where I ended up, at least for today's journey. I ended up in the Sylvia Beach Memorial Reading Room at Shakespeare and Company with you, David. Anyway,
well, thank you very much, Michael. And to Komen listeners, I hope that you have been surprised by the reading of poetry on the radio for a half an hour by Michael McGee.
So we're going to come back to the beginning, and it really is, it's a poem written at the start of this year. It's a New Year's poem. So it's particularly apropos to end and begin with. It's called The Love of New Resolutions, and it takes us back to James Joyce. I feel as itinerant as James Joyce, a kind of transplant with an egg cup, casting out lines in my BVDs and playing old episodes of Inspector Morse. While I nibble away at life in love with raspberry vines, I'm looking for a love of something that will fill my time. And alone in my apartment, this studio with its white noise and its beige walls and lots of lamps to add atmosphere and light, avoiding the footfalls I hear outside, the cries from the street of people pushing their shopping carts. I worship Caravaggio and I worship Van Gogh. I have a calendar with a pool table and a photograph of sunset at Old Sarum near the city of Salisbury. But mainly I gorge myself with dreams and desires of fame I'll never have. Throw me a rope, someone. I'll pull myself up. Give me a coffee. It's right down there on the floor. I'll stir in my own ashes. Give me some cash and I'll spread it around evenly. I promise you, pretending I'm wealthy enough to keep wearing these same holy socks.
Now we will go for Pachine. Goodbye, listeners. This is David Gilmour with Michael McGee and his more recent poems and some from his journals. Look for them in the bookstores.
King's
Bookstores in Tacoma.